Whatever you want.
Good afternoon, and congratulations on your new chairmanship.
Thank you.
I'm Morgan Tracy with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, the project manager for Recap 6, and with me today is Phil Namony in about half of his voice. He's one of our co-authors on this project. Thank you for having us here today. We're here to give you an overview of the Recap 6 project, and Phil will give you some additional information about several items that are of most relevance to this commission. But before I talk about Recap 6, I want to give you a little background and context about our regulatory improvement program. As you know, things change. Land use and development are different than they were 20 years ago, and they're different than they were 5 years ago, and as such, our codes need to react to that. To stay up to date and effectively address development and land uses in the city, this program continually updates the city's codes in a way that fosters desirable development. Problems with the code are identified by staff, the public, other interested stakeholders, and are entered into a central database. These items are reviewed and ranked by evaluating the impacts of and our ability to improve the regulations, the variety of stakeholders that are affected, and how widespread the particular issue is. The database currently contains more than 800 broad-ranging requests. Addressing these requests can result in smaller topic-specific projects like our recent historic code improvement project or large complex projects like the citywide tree project. Then there are the various odds and ends. These are not making major changes to policy, not establishing new policy, but include things like technical fixes, clarifications, and some minor course corrections to existing policy. These are the items that we address in RECAP. So RECAP, some say RICAP, stands for Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package. It's only one product of our regulatory improvement program, and is specifically limited to those clarifications, corrections, and minor changes in policy. There are about 280 items, about a quarter of the items in our database that are eligible for RECAP. They're sort of the smaller, distinct, minor policy issues. And we address them on a generally annual revolving cycle, sort of like when we think about the Golden Gate Bridge being painted. They start on one end of the bridge, make their way to the end, and start all over again the next year. That's what we do. To date, we have addressed over 200 items in the five previous recaps, which brings us to Recap 6. So the Recap 6 work plan, staff selected the top-ranking items from our database with an eye toward not tackling those items that are likely to be addressed in the near term as part of the comprehensive plan update implementation project. So things like the centers and corridors mixed-use zoning project, we'll be touching on a lot of the areas in the commercial zones, and we wanted to avoid amending portions of the code that will be rewritten in the near future. The work plan for Recap 6 was adopted by the Planning and Sustainability Commission at a public hearing on August 13th. Staff then, with its marching orders, researched the 45 items and their problem descriptions more thoroughly, looking back into the legislative intent and enabling legislation, and then worked closely with other Bureau staff to evaluate possible solutions, including both non-regulatory fixes and regulatory changes. After the initial research and code drafting, a set of initial recommendations has emerged. That's what's presented in our discussion draft. The 45 items fall into one of three categories. We have minor policy changes, which respond to changing need, new laws, court rulings, or new technology and innovations, but they don't modify existing policy. Secondly, we have clarifications, which ensure the code is being applied consistent with the already adopted policy. And third, we have a set of items that did not result in code amendments. So there are several reasons why we wouldn't choose to amend the code through RECAP. First, a regulatory solution may not be worth the costs or added complexity, or the existing regulation is achieving the desired result. Second, the research shows that the issue is important, but the solution should be decided as part of a bigger project. So as we got into the details, we've realized we really need a lot more eyes on this. And similarly, third, more information or public input is needed before we can make a solid recommendation about a particular change. So that's sort of the context of RECAP and Recap 6. The discussion draft has been released for public comment and will be available for comment through February 21st. Currently, staff are holding or attending Neighborhood District Coalition meetings and holding an open house on February 11th in that room behind us in 2500 A or B. 2500B. And at the open house, we'll be here to answer and respond to questions as they come up. So after we've received the comments, we'll incorporate them into a formal proposed draft in March for a public hearing back in front of the Planning and Sustainability Commission in April. In May, the City Council will hold their hearing on the final recommended draft. And with that, I'll turn it over to Phil to touch on the items that are of particular importance.
Afternoon, Phil Namini with Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And I think Morgan had passed out or had sent with your packet sort of a little two-pager that had the list of all the items. And he had highlighted four of the items that I was going to spend a little bit of time discussing, but we're welcome to receive questions on any of the items that that you would like to ask or issues that you have questions about. But of the four items I'm going to go through, the first one is issue on the short-term rentals / bed and breakfast regulations. This is probably the regulation that, or the issue that has probably generated the most comment so far out of our discussion draft. Currently, we do have a process where through a conditional use review, an applicant or a homeowner can request to run a bed and breakfast facility through their house as and it's a type 2 conditional use review generally, but that applies whether they're renting one room or up to 5 rooms. And as some of you may know, there's been an explosion of sort of informal room rentals on a short-term basis through things like VRBO and Airbnb. And it's something that has affected the City of Portland just like most other major cities throughout the country. And rather than try to take a very heavy-handed regulatory approach, we looked at a way to potentially provide an opportunity for some of these to operate without affecting the neighborhood to a great extent. And so what we've come up with is a proposal to look at some of the smaller scale ones where people are renting just one or two bedrooms, similar to a home occupation permit. And they would go through that process, which notifies the immediate neighborhood and gets a permit process. And that way we are also able to keep a record and work with our Revenue Bureau, because we do actually get revenue transient lodging taxes from these facilities if we know about them. So this would establish a fairly simple process for these kind of smaller scale persons just renting an extra bedroom in their house. If they're doing 3 to 5, they would still go through the type 2 conditional use review. That would not change. One other thing we wanted to mention in terms of how that relates maybe a little bit to the Landmarks Commission is the current code requires that bed and breakfast facilities going through the CU process be in homes that have been around at least 5 years. Now, of course, that doesn't make them historic, but the intent of that was to not have people build a home specifically to run as a bed and breakfast facility, since these are operated in single dwelling zones. We are going to keep that sort of 5-year rule for the 3 to 5 units. So that will essentially, if they are going through conditional use review, it will be on a home that was initially built as a single family dwelling before, you know, they can come in and do ask for a conditional use review for a bed and breakfast facility. So that's that one. The other one I want to go through that does have a little bit of effect on the minor policy item is the issue of whether the zoning code applies in the right-of-way, especially in terms of for historic districts and historic landmarks. And actually, historically, our code usually does not apply to the right-of-way in general. However, in design overlay zones, which when the code was written also included the historic resources and historic districts, the intent was that non-standard improvements in the right-of-way were also supposed to be subject to design review. About 15 or so years ago, we actually separated out the historic review chapters from the design review chapters. That provision stayed in the design review chapters but didn't get incorporated into the historic review chapters. It wasn't really an issue, but recently the Vista Bridge and some of the work on being done on the Vista Bridge with the fencing and so on that's being proposed came up, and that is a historic landmark, but it's also in the right-of-way. So that issue came up about whether the city had design oversight through a design review process on that, and the The original intent was that the city should have design oversight. So we are proposing a code amendment that essentially corrects the error that was made 15 or so years ago. The third item that was shaded is a very simple kind of clarification. It has to do with the Landmarks Commission membership. And up until, about 2 years ago, we used to have, I think, both the Design Commission and the Landmarks Commission used to have Planning and Sustainability Commission member on board. And that, essentially, that was, after a while, the PSC member was, since it was a volunteer member, they were being stretched kind of thin. And there was an agreement that that was potentially not necessary, and I think there'd be a briefing that would happen between those two. While that kind of process got cleared up, the zoning code did not. And so the zoning code still said that there were 8 members of the Historic Landmarks Commission as well as 8 members of the Design Commission. And so this is just essentially a clarification to run that down to 7, which is what the current process is. So the last item I wanted to go through is actually, it falls under the category of non-amendment, but it was a question that came up about whether should be an application of the community design standards for residential-only projects in conservation districts and for conservation landmarks. State law does require that in most instances that if we have a design overlay zone that we should allow a clear and objective path for residential projects. Essentially, we do that through the use of the community design standards where somebody can opt to either go through the review or meet the standards. The question that had come up with the development of our conservation districts and conservation landmarks was whether that was considered a historic resource under state law, because state law does allow in certain areas, like certain plan districts like Gateway and the Central City, for us to not have to provide that clear and objective standards. And one of the areas is with historic districts. And so Morgan actually was working on that one, and through some conversations and research on behalf of him and the city attorney, it was determined that we can look at conservation districts and landmarks as a historic resource, and we do not need to provide the clear and objective standards that if you go above a certain threshold on a residential project that we can require you to go through design review. And that is actually how our code is currently written. It's just there was some interpretation questions that came about from that. So because our code is currently written that way, we have elected not to make any amendments to that. So if there's any other questions on those items or any of the other 40-plus items, either Morgan and I can answer on that.
Questions, guys? Yeah, Paul. Kirk.
Sorry. Just a couple of questions about the application of the zoning code in the right-of-way. Would the zoning code apply to right-of-way that's only owned by the city of Portland, or what about right-of-way that's owned by Multnomah County and or the state?
That's an interesting question
about the state right-of-way. That's a really good question.
So it's intended to apply to public rights-of-way, so there's one distinction between private rights-of-way, like private streets, mm-hmm. and public streets. Mm-hmm. So the zoning code already addresses private rights-of-way. In terms of public rights-of-way, that's an excellent question on the state rights-of-way. I believe that, Tim, do you have any impression on that?
I'm waiting to see what you
said. Okay. I think rather than be wrong, let me look into that and I'll have Tim report back to you, but it's a good question.
And then, especially given a lot of the bridges are, you know, county bridges, yeah. that kind of thing.
That's right. And I guess the Oregon Department of Transportation just listed a whole slew of the bridges on the National Register. So it'd be good to understand and to coordinate more closely both with ODOT and Multnomah County.
One thing to add on that, sure. to keep in mind though, is because this is affecting historic resources, mm-hmm. Now, in some cases, the bridges across Willamette can also be potentially a landmark, but if the bridge isn't a historic resource, then that essentially, this change wouldn't affect it. So there may be some cases where the bridge is not a landmark or in an environmental zone. Mm-hmm. But I don't think our zoning code probably doesn't distinguish, so I would assume that our city process would essentially apply.
Okay.
And the other question I had with the zoning code in the right of way, would that also apply to cellular facilities being located on telephone poles as well?
To the extent that those facilities are in a historic district, then potentially it could. So there is an exemption that already exists for design districts that says that standard improvements in the right-of-way are exempt from review. Mm-hmm. So it's more a question whether the city engineer would adopt those as quote-unquote standard improvements or not. And okay. I think there's discussion that's going on about that right now.
Okay. Yeah. Would you just keep us updated when the decision's made?
Actually, I think you may be getting a briefing on that this Thursday. So
okay. Yeah, so I'll follow up on that. So on Thursday, among other things, we have a special joint hearing with the Design Commission, the Landmarks Commission, to review at least within the comment period for a new FCC ruling on the docket, which would potentially include exempting cell, a newer version of cell facilities, and these are kind of smaller scale urban environment cell facilities that wouldn't necessarily be located on rooftops, but actually on the faces of buildings, about 30 feet in the air, maybe in the right of way, like on light poles. If you remember, we had Wi-Fi Portland not too long ago, and these little mushroom caps showed up on all the light poles. Something like that, but different, because there's multiple carriers, so there's multiple things. So that's something we're going to talk, and who will be here on Thursday, the 30th, with both you and the Design Commission will be the Office of Communities Technology. And they are the handlers of the franchise agreements with the cell providers, particularly for right-of-way. So they would be great people for the commission to hear from relative to what is happening in historic districts. Are these things considered, I'm thinking of poles or monopoles and co-locating on these RF facilities on existing poles or replacing poles with facilities. Let's have a conversation about what the standards are, what the expectations are. And this code clarification, as Phil and Morgan has already said, is something that should have been that way forever. So we're just kind of backing up into it. But it's a good time next Thursday, since everyone will be in the room that impacts, meaning the regulators, the industry, the commissions, and the stakeholders, to make that a highlight and point of clarification at that hearing.
Okay. And as far as the right-of-way stuff goes, like where there's, you know, policy in place, say like Chinatown's a good example, where there's kind of a right-of-way plan that's kind of based on the district and stuff, I assume that's kind of separate from this. This is really more about if someone wants to, you know, we're not going to review every light pole or something that goes into the district, right?
Right.
I'll hang out.
Yeah.
So if there are adopted design guidelines in place, you know, one of the challenges we had previous to this change going into effect are some of the design guidelines speak to activities in the right of way, but we had a problem making a connection between those two.
Mm-hmm.
So this will resolve some of that, as well as if there are specific guidelines that were adopted by the city engineer, they're already supposed to be implementing those on behalf of their own Title 17. But this sort of makes it more holistic, comprehensive part of the review.
I'm trying to think of a couple of relevant examples over the last 6 years, and two that come to mind are, one was Linda Dodds, who used to sit on the commission, was a big proponent of the right-of-way history. And, you know, occasionally we had, like, where in-street bioswale might take out a historic curb with, you know, horse rings, say. You know, is that something then that would come to the commission for review and comment, or is that, I mean, we basically, it was outside of our purview at that point, so we could say, oh, we don't like that, but really didn't mean anything.
How should I say this? It's a big city with a lot of moving parts. Yes, absolutely, to answer your question, the commission should be involved to the degree in which I think these are things we need to address. I think one of the issues clarifying the number of commissioners actually being 7, we did used to be 8, and one of the reasons why we did that is because it was impossible to have a planning and sustainability commission person serve 2 volunteer commissions. And so the chairs have the opportunity to meet quarterly, and that is exactly the kind of thing the chair should be discussing, is that kind of cross-jurisdictional concern. Because I know you'll have support from the Design Commission, and you'll definitely, the Planning Sustainability Commission will want to hear that too. And that, unlike some other issues that have come up relative to interpretations or banners, signs, things like that, I think those are things that need to be hot topics, and that ones that this commission can take forward in their State of the City, or as the Design Commission has as well, and definitely something where we could bring in others in for the conversation and say, look, are bioswales appropriate in historic districts?
Right. Okay. Yeah, just trying to understand where our boundaries might be there, you know. And then another one that came up, which did come to the commission, but it sounds like maybe didn't need to, at least legally, was the Randy Leonard's Luce, and there was one proposed for Chinatown, which was going to be placed in the right-of-way. But it sounds like that was just probably advisory in retrospect versus...
Yeah, on that particular issue, Art DeMuro at the time spoke out very loudly about his feelings on the Lou and the design of the current kind of one-step model, and that did have an impact and basically pushed the Lou's out of historic boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Do you guys have any other questions for these guys?
Just one more question in terms of the relationship of that particular application of the zoning code to PBOT and just streetscape improvement projects, just to kind of build on what Brian has said in the past. Yeah, I mean, a lot can happen in the right-of-way.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, I remember my days at Chippo, for instance, there were significant disagreements that emerged when kind of a very standard approach to streetscape improvements occurred throughout the state. And I think eventually there was kind of a consensus reached on how to be sensitive within the historic environments, but it would be nice to know what the kind of the standard, you know, what's considered a standard, what was the language you had before? The
standard improvement?
Standard. What constitutes a standard improvement?
Well, I think that's a good topic for discussion. There is an adopted document of city specifications for improvements, how wide a sidewalk needs to be, how thick the concrete needs to be, so far.
Right.
In terms of being respective of the historic context, I'm not sure how nuanced those guidelines get or the standard improvements get.
Perhaps ultimately, I think what BPS is looking for is comments from the commission that could take the form in writing as well. You'll be meeting with the Plain Sustainability Commission tomorrow.
Just briefing,
yeah. Just a quick briefing, but the comment period is open until February 6th?
21st.
Excuse me, 21st. Wow. Ooh.
Lots of time.
So what the commission may decide to do is kind of maybe pick some points that are highlights, like, Kurt, I think what you're getting at is clarifying that issue altogether. And I think that can kind of set the stage for conversation, kind of get some attention on the issue. Like, used to be, well, I'm glad we're enforcing standards that should have been in place since 1996. So, by the way, let's look at these other things that apply, like stormwater treatments, and kind of use that as a platform to move forward. And then that can relate to the chair's meeting. It could be a topic of discussion perhaps at our future retreat. And then also, ultimately, we can invite PBOT for a briefing to the commission and some period of time to talk about some of these issues. And we've done that before with the Design Commission as well. On kind of some of those multi-jurisdictional areas and how the commission can play a role advisory and why that matters and impress upon those leaders why these things should be set in a certain way.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Then I had a couple of other questions on ones that weren't highlighted, actually. So under the minor policy items, the public art for ground floor windows, which looks like it allows basically a mural in lieu of meeting the window storefront requirement. Is that also in historic districts, or how does that get applied, I guess? And am I reading that correctly? Is that what it's doing?
Well, basically, the the allowance would apply. It would allow somebody, instead of asking for an adjustment, it would sort of waive the requirement to go through an adjustment. Now, if there's exterior alterations being proposed to a landmark or historic district, that in itself triggers a design review, historic resource review, regardless of whether they're meeting the window requirements or not. So as part of that review, since that's affecting the exterior of the building, I think that people would be in line to be able to ask questions about that. We're also not allowing that to occur in the central city. The central city, which of course is another place that requires design review. There could be negotiation and discussion as part of the overall design review and modifications, but there's not a flat-out adjustment, waiver of the adjustment in the central city.
Okay. Some of the designated rack represented from Landmark, so partly just curious about how that like overlaps with their mission and stuff there. And then the other one on the no amendments, the top one on mechanical equipment screening, was that it says wall-mounted mechanical equipment. Did you guys also look at roof equipment? Because that's one issue that's come up in the past, is just a conflict between like what the Park Service wants on rooftop equipment versus what the code says and what Landmarks may want. I don't know if that's what that was addressing or if that was something else.
It was the focus was more on the wall-mounted equipment. There was some issues that have been brought about roof-mounted equipment, but the issues that actually got brought up were whether our code adequately addressed the issue, like with non-conforming upgrades, the requirement for screening of rooftop equipment. And actually, you know, our code currently does require as one of the items for non-conforming upgrade that you do screening, and screening means everything from can include ground-mounted equipment, you know, trash enclosures, as well as the rooftop-mounted equipment. So the feeling was there wasn't a need to amend the code to become more or less strict on there. It appeared that the code itself was addressing the issue of requirements for screening rooftop-mounted equipment. The question of, you know, whether certain bureaus agree with that, or, you know, from a historically with a historically sensitive building, whether our code does an adequate job of addressing that or provides enough flexibility, I think that would be part of what gets discussed with a historic design review or historic resource review. And, you know, modifications can always be asked for that if there's some alternative to our standard approach. The wall-mounted equipment, the reason why we chose not to address that is it became a bigger issue and more wide-ranging, because we really don't have code that actually addresses that in our general base zones, in our sensitive areas and design overlay zones, and we didn't really have the knowledge base to really create a whole new kind of screening requirement as far as these things that are kind of like heat pumps and things like that that are starting to get just kind of plopped on the side of the building. And so it doesn't mean that it's not an issue that we needed to address. It was something that kind of turned into maybe a bigger deal, but that maybe should be looked at in terms of, in general, like if we want to extend some sort of design requirements for things like multifamily housing, and where we see that probably more often.
Okay. Well, if you guys do discuss that more and revisit it, we might want to just have a conversation here at the Landmarks Commission, just because we had a pretty big case, the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine, that went in Old Town, and the code required screening the mechanical equipment, and so we kind of held that standard. They ended up, it was going to threaten their historic tax credit funding because National Park Service wouldn't sign off. So it was an area where the city code was in conflict with the Park Service, and they had to come back and go through the whole process again to then appeal that requirement after the fact, which was just kind of an onerous process for them. So just trying to figure out, you know, and maybe there's not a way to align the standards there, but how that might apply to screening equipment, though, because it could be a fairly simple fix in the code that might allow an alternative or something. I don't know how it would be worded. It's for you guys, but we do have, if there's no more questions from the commission, one public comment that I think is relative to the recap. John Zarnicki?
Yes.
Forward. Thanks. Hope I pronounced your name right.
Comfortable guy now.
Please state your name and address it into
sure.
the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Commissioners. I'm John Zarnicki, 208 Northwest Southwest Stark Street, principal at New Traditional Architecture and former chair of the Landmarks Commission.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's a nice room. The reason I'm here or commenting today, I wasn't going to actually until I saw this, and that's item number 37. Historic Landmarks Commission and Design Commission membership. That's correct membership number from 8 to 7 to reflect current membership composition. I guess I'm concerned only because the clarification or the reason doesn't seem to reflect that there was ever any need for coordination between the commissions and among the three commissions. And so that implies that whatever's going on now is what should have been done before. And that is more clearly reflect what's really going on. In other words, commissioners are not showing up. So I'd recommend that this change be not adopted, simply because the coordination among the commissions that depend on sustainability is really supported by the recognition of landmarks as being fundamental to the sustainability of the city and of the region, even because landmarks are in fact a resource that should be managed just like any other precious resource that we have, and the management of that resource is not only the purview of the Landmarks Commission, but is also the purview of the Design Commission and the Planning and Sustainability Commission, so that some means by which those efforts could be coordinated, even informally, by the presence of the commissioners here, I think would be greatly improved, and I think is very necessary. I know that it was useful when I was a commission chair because we were able to talk to each other informally, and messages could go back and forth. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate
for your
comments.
Yep. I think just to follow up on Mr. Zarnicki's testimony there, we're trying, and I think Tim touched on this. I mean, yes, cross coordination between the different commissions is super important. We've realized that and recognized that in the past that we weren't doing as good of a job as we could there. So the way we've tried to handle that is by having our quarterly chairs luncheons, which are basically informal meetings, and keeping that line of communication open so that we can communicate on issues that are important there. The reality was having that eighth member that was going to serve on now all three commissions instead of two is just not realistic and wasn't working. So that was how we addressed that.
The other thing I think it's important to note that there is this joint meeting happening on Radio Towers on Thursday, and there has been talk about amongst leadership of having more all commission-wide hearings when it comes to sort of big policy issues. My expectation may be with the Southwest Corridor Plan, there may be some joint hearings there, opportunities for joint hearings there, or on discrete issues like the radio tower.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely. Anything else? Well, thank you, Phil and Morgan. We appreciate
it. Yeah, great.
It.
Thanks for your comments.
That was helpful.